As promised on Tuesday, I said I'd release part two of A Crusade Dies at Varna. If you are new to the show, I'd invite you to check out episode 21, part one, so you know what's happening. You'll find my email in the show notes if you'd like to get in touch with me. So let's jump right in. A Crusade Dies at Varna, part two, episode 21. On Tuesday earlier this week, we left the Crusaders just a day's ride from the Black Sea coastal city of Varna. Murad was recalled by Sultan Mehmed to lead his armies, and Murad did return, but he insisted he only wanted the job of a general, and he had no intentions of becoming Sultan again. In the Crusader camp, supplies were running low, and scouts reported the Venetian navy was nowhere to be seen. So, by November the 2nd, 1444, the Crusaders camped a few miles away from Varna and held council to see what game plan they were going to come up with. Meanwhile, in Anatolia, Murad stood with an army numbering some 40,000. The biggest obstacle for Murad was getting his troops across the straits, but with the Venetians controlling the sea lanes, he was basically stuck. A solution, however, presented itself from out of nowhere. A Genoese envoy arrived late one night in Murad's camp. The offer he made was almost too good to pass up. The Genoese would ferry Ottoman forces across the straits and keep the Venetians away, all for a price. The price being one gold ducat per head, every head, of Murad's men. Make no mistake, this was an outrageous sum. With 40,000 men, the Ottomans would be coughing up a pretty penny. Why would, though, the Genoese, allied to the Crusaders, agree to such a thing, though? Well, the Genoese were in competition, and sometimes open warfare, with the Venetians. The Venetians had attacked Genoese trading outposts and cities throughout the eastern Mediterranean. If the Crusaders were successful, then it wasn't too far-fetched to see, from the perspective of the Genoese, the rest of their holdings passing over into the hands of the Venetians. Thus, somewhere along the line, they decided to even the scales a bit. Arriving in Roumelia, Murad marched with all haste towards the Crusaders. Picking up every able-bodied man he could find, by the time Murad's army passed Ed Rine, it had numbered some 60,000 men. Recovering from his shock, Mehmed joined in this army along with his handler, Kandarli. But he would be kept far away from the upcoming battle, as nobody wanted to lose another sultan in a battle. In Kandarli's case, it would be equally disastrous if his charge, Mehmed, somehow was victorious. Then that almighty conquering Ottoman army might just execute the regent himself, march down to Ed Rine, and make preparations for this insane idea of attacking Constantinople. On November the 9th, 1444, scouts reported to the Crusaders' commanders there was a large Ottoman army bearing down on their position, with none other than Murad at its helm. The Crusader leadership had another huddle. Despite their strategically weak situation, spirits were looking pretty high. It looked as though they were finally going to get the battle they'd all signed up for. Among the most enthusiasts, the greatest was King Vladislav himself. During the long march through the Balkans, he had sat around his campfire, listening to the papal legate, Cesarini, drone on, about how the Crusaders would be made legends in their own time, that this invincible Ottoman myth would be shattered forever. And it wasn't just the young king embedded with dreams of glory. With him was his elite bodyguard, a contingent of the most powerfully armed, best horses, best weapons, and generally all-around badasses the Crusaders had. They were the sons of Europe's greatest nobles, From France, Poland, Germany, Italy, there wasn't none among their number who didn't trace his lineage back at least 300 years. These guys number total 500. And for all intents and purposes, this 500 elite bodyguard was the creme de la creme of the crusading force. Unstoppable on the battlefield, the dreaded Frankish charges these knights could level against an enemy, along with the spectacle of their banners and heralds flying in the wind, they were the blitzkrieg of their day and feared by all, especially the Ottomans. I bring up King Vladislav and his elite guard of mounted knights for a reason, too, and this will become obvious as the battle unfolds later. The mood in the Crusader camp was high. Everybody wanted to fight, including Hunyadi. Besides, Hunyadi reminded everyone present, it wasn't like they had any choice in the matter. It was only a matter of days before their food ran out, and those damn Venetians wouldn't be showing up to evacuate anyone. An actual recorded quote from John Hunyadi goes like this, quote, "To escape is impossible, to surrender is unthinkable. Let us fight with bravery and honor of our arms," end quote. Sitting around the campfire and raising their goblets, Cesarini proposed a toast to the upcoming victory, and King Vladislav ordered that 1 hour before sunrise, the horn be set and everyone form up for battle. All throughout the night, Cesarini strode with his gaggle of priests, doing all they could to assure everyone God was going to hand them victory the next morning. Around midnight, Turkish war drums could be heard in the distance, growing louder and louder. The crusaders quietly slipped into their armor as they slept. The Ottomans roused earlier than the Christians the next morning. Murad decided on a battle tactic to envelop the Christian army from the sides and slowly use his superior numbers to wear the crusaders down. With his flanks crushing the crusaders' wings, he'd march his center forward, inch by inch, until, hemmed in on three different sides, the crusaders would either break and make a run for it, or be completely surrounded and killed to a man. Murad was well aware of John Hunyadi's military victories against his armies in Wallachia and Serbia, and he wanted to make damn sure they didn't repeat their same mistakes. Mistakes that the crafty Hunyadi could exploit in real time and turn the tide of a battle in his favor within seconds. So, Murad took extra care in setting up his chess pieces. First, if you recall in extra episode number 5, I talked about an Ottoman commander named Sahah Bedreddin who had been humiliated and defeated by Hunyadi up in Wallachia years before. Well, Murad had not cast his failed servant aside just yet and placed him in charge of the all-important Ottoman left flank. Made up of troops from Rumelia, Sahah Bedreddin had been itching for a fight ever since his defeat, and he was eager to throw himself into this battle. On Murad's right flank, he placed his capable son-in-law. Both these Ottoman flanks were made up of Azab infantry soldiers and Sepahi cavalry. The Azabs carried lances, short swords, and were also archers. They were lightly armed, and their true strength lay in their sheer numbers. The Sepahi cavalry held from both Rumelia and Anatolia. They were men granted land by the Sultan, allowed to harvest crops for profit, and in return, they were expected to maintain horses, weapons, and training, and be ready to be called upon their master when required. When it was all set up, the Ottoman left flank made up of about 15,000 soldiers, and the right flank of 18,000. Murad himself commanded the center with 35,000 men. At least 10,000 of these were the elite and well-disciplined Janissaries. Trained since childhood in the arts of fighting and war, iron-willed, these guys personified self-discipline, bravery, hardiness, and to a man were willing and eager to die before the eyes of their master. The Janissaries' greatest strength lay in their unit cohesion and weapons. They were heavily armored, carried swords, bows, axes, throwing lances, and most especially, they had gunpowder on their side. The story of gunpowdered arms, which originated in China from way back when, could be a podcast series all its own, but most European armies in the 1440s had almost no cannons. And what cannons they did possess sat atop castle walls or were too big to really lug around. Now, that's not to say all European armies didn't have gunpowdered weapons, just that like 90% didn't. And at Varna, the Ottoman Janissaries had a force of roughly 1,000 men, armed and trained with the arquebus, a barrel-loaded firearm that took a hell of a long time to reload, wasn't accurate at all concerning long ranges, but its real strength is that it was absolutely deadly at about 30 feet or closer, especially if fired in a volley. The Janissaries would go on after Varna in perfecting the use of firearms and incorporate them into their training, tactics, and experimentation, being the only standing army in Europe equipped and trained with firearms. Murad ordered a ditch to be dug around a small hill he had perched his headquarters upon, and then he lined this with iron spikes for extra measure. Careful not to underestimate the possibility of Hun Yadi pulling out a victory, like he had 5 times in the past against the Ottomans, Murad ordered camels to be put right outside his tent and filled with gold, laces, and spices. Murad's thinking was that if his center position was overrun, as Hun Yadi was quite capable of doing, then the greedy Hungarians would be too busy busting the camels laden with treasure, and they probably wouldn't pursue a fleeing Murad as he made his getaway. Now, I thought this a bit hilarious, but then again, upon second thought, I wasn't there on that hill, and it wasn't me facing the invincible Hun Yadi. Watching the Ottomans form up across the way was Hun Yadi. He studied his foe's movements for a bit before deciding on what exactly he was going to do. He, of course, saw what Murad was up to, and he realized the Crusaders had to negate the superior numbers of the Ottomans if they were going to make it out of this alive. The terrain flattened as you marched closer to the Ottoman positions, while if you marched towards the Crusaders, the plain would dip into marshlands, very poor for enemy cavalry to cross, and on the other side were a series of hills and rocks. In the center, there was a place where the marshlands and rocky area separated. If Hun Yadi could entice the Ottomans into attacking along this narrow strip, then the Crusaders could fight them piecemeal at a time. And then, hopefully, and with God smiling upon them, the Crusaders' superior armor, training, and stamina would hopefully, win the day. As soon as he formed up, the Crusaders into a convex formation. In the center would be Hun Yadi at the choke point. All the Ottomans had to do was march right in. Confident that his center could hold, especially in such formidable terrain, Hun Yadi's weakness could be found in his flanks. If the Ottomans overran either his left or right, then they could attack the center from multiple directions. And with the Ottomans' superior numbers, well, I'll let my listeners do the math on this one. On Hun Yadi's left flank, he placed his personal troops from Transylvania. These guys were experienced professionals and had been with Hun Yadi for years. Along with his men were different contingents from the various Christian nations who were all represented in the crusade. Among their number were Saxon knights, clad from head to toe in steel armor, and I'm going to bring up these Saxon dudes in a few minutes. His left flank numbered 8,000 men. His right flank was made up of the papal troops, Wallachian horsemen under the command of the vampire Dracula's older brother, Mircea II, along with the majority of the Hungarian heavy infantry. Hun Yadi's right flank numbered 7,000 men. Hun Yadi realized, when Murad was approaching, that the Ottoman commanders would see the flatlands behind his right flank, and this would be where the Ottomans' first attempt would be to break the Crusaders. As such, he wanted to make sure the leaders of his right flank were well aware of the necessity of holding their position at all cost. The center, commanded by Hunyadi himself, numbered 10,000 men, 7,000 heavy infantry troops from Hungary, King Vladislav's elite bodyguard, the 500 badass knights I mentioned earlier, a force of mercenaries recruited from all over Europe, and I think they were about 3,000, and some troops from Transylvania making up the rest. Behind Hunyadi's center was about 1,000 Czech mercenaries who had campaigned with him from way long ago in Italy. They manned several dozen war wagons, an example of which I pulled up from the internet, and you can actually see it on this show's artwork for the episode. These were immense vehicles and armored against weapons. Treated against fire attacks, they were highly mobile and positioned to provide overlapping fields of fire for the 500 or so crossbowmen of the Czech mercenaries. These porcupine-like mobile forts would be copied by the Ottomans and put to good use in their campaigns in the Middle East a few years later. The purpose of these mobile forts were to provide a place for the Crusaders to retreat, just in case things started breaking bad for the Crusaders, and protect their supplies and rations. Both sides took roughly 5 hours to form up ranks. While forming up, the weather, which in the early morning had gone from clear and sunny to now increasingly cloudy and dark, a sudden wind is said to have blown in from the Black Sea. It was strong enough to snap several poles carrying the heralds, banners, and flags of many companies of crusading troops. The main force of 500 elite heavy cavalry surrounding the king, however, were unaffected, as their poles were all reinforced. But the lesser, poorer troops from Italy, Germany, France, and such regions looked on with superstitious terror as their standards were now in the mud. For a superstitious 15th century soldier, a gust of wind breaking your colors was a matter of grave concern. And already grumblings and upset were spreading up and down the Christian lines. Cardinal Cesarini rode in and around like a crazy person, and he also dispatched his priest and tried to assure the troops that God was on their side despite the ill omen. The military history of Europe is replete with examples of storms, lightning strikes, or the auspicious paranormal appearance of this or that sign in the sky, dream portents, events, which may or may not have actually happened. Yet, they are so often linked to a military disaster by later writers. Whatever the case, at Varna on that November day in 1444, the breaking of so many standards has been mentioned repeatedly throughout all the literature I studied. Ottoman sources also mention the Christian herald's breaking because, as the Christians grew restless and fearful at the sudden sign from the heavens, Murad II observed this as well. Hoping to take advantage of what he perceived as panic brewing amongst his opponents, Murad ordered the Azab infantry in his center to advance. His intention wasn't a full-scale-out attack, not quite yet, but he wanted to test the Christians. On the other side, Cesarini was rapidly losing control of the spreading situation. The invocations of Mary, Queen of Heaven, and all the saints weren't enough to still the fear in the hearts of the crusading foot soldiers, especially when the horn blared and the hated Turkish war drums added a B-flat ambience of terror from 400 yards away to the entire spectacle. To make matters worse, the Ottoman soldiers across the way began to taunt the crusaders. Their insults were lost among the harsh winds and times of history, but their taunts, combined with the Turkish war drums and the growing fear in the crusader ranks, now a contingent of Azab infantry was spotted advancing towards them. The crusaders began to turn into a pressure keg, but the pressure was most likely felt by the Saxon knights that I mentioned earlier on Hunyadi's left flank. They began to stare at each other, these Saxon knights, and ask themselves, why in the world was Hunyadi just sitting there and not doing anything about these damned Ottomans? Wasn't the entire purpose of marching out to this godforsaken land to fight and destroy the Turks? Now we have to remember, the smart thing, according to Hunyadi's original plan, would have been for the Saxon knights to do as they had been ordered. The crusaders were heavily outnumbered by a veteran army superbly trained and led. Hunyadi's plan was to hold the center and force the Ottomans to send in their forces piecemeal, bottled up by the terrain. The only hinge was that his left and right flanks just had to hold at all cost. Now, Hunyadi looked up and, wait a minute, what the hell are my Saxon knights doing? The Saxon knights charged forward without orders, without authorization, and in complete defiance of their original charge to hold fast against an Ottoman attack from their left flank positions, and they went straight into the advancing Azov infantry. Hunyadi stomped around and was furious as he watched his left flank suddenly become weakened. The Saxon knights crash into the Azovs and cut down several of their numbers easily. However, close on the heels of the Azov were the Sapiha cavalry of the Ottomans. The knights charge right at them, but the Ottoman cavalry expertly open ranks, allow the Saxons to ride in between them, and then close the ranks around them and began attacking the knights from multiple directions. Yikes. Suddenly, the Saxon force was in huge, huge trouble. No doubt cursing heavily, Hunyadi ordered Mircea to deploy his redoubtable horsemen and rescue the knights. I imagine this force was a stunning sight to behold. Their beaver fur hats, long badass beards, curved swords, it must have been an incredible sight. Well, incredible if you're looking at it from the crusader standpoint. The Wallachians drove a wedge into the Sapiha ranks, and what was left of the Saxons managed to escape. Watching all of this from his hill, especially as the Christians peeled away a large force from their right flank, Murad decided that now the time was to attack the Christian right, to take advantage of the situation. This force he ordered forward was composed of the Ottoman soldiers and cavalry from Rumelia, hardened guys who had faced Hunyadi before. I should mention very briefly about the quality of the Ottoman Rumelian troops. And remember, Rumelia is the Ottoman Balkans controlled by the Ottoman Empire. It is these guys that Rumelia had lots of experience in fighting armored knights. The troops from Rumelia literally knew where the chinks in their enemy's armor was. On top of that, these guys had learned through, after a century of hard lessons, that arrows, blades, and lances did little against a formidable Christian armor. As such, they had modified their inventory of weapons to include stuff that caused a wave concussion effect. Things like maces, battle axes, and spiked weapons, devices that would deliver a debilitating shockwave, cracking bones and crushing skulls. The Christian right witnessed the Ottoman advance, and also that they were outnumbered, so the Christians dug in with spikes and lances, hoping to ride out this charge. However, there were simply too damn many Ottomans, smashing the Christians with their maces and axes. Pretty soon, Hunyadi's right flank faltered as men ran away into the safety of the battle wagons. With Hunyadi's right flank now collapsing, the Ottomans captured virtually all of the Christian banners and heralds as war trophies, some of which can still be seen in Istanbul to this day. Hunyadi peeled away a huge portion of the center and wheeled up to save his right flank. By the time he rode up there, the only force left fighting was Cardinal Cesarini and about 600 foot soldiers whom had formed up beneath the banner of St. Vladislav. Hunyadi's counterattack drove the Ottoman troops away with heavy losses. At 2 p.m., both the Ottomans and Crusaders pulled apart and began to lick their wounds. Both sides were exhausted with plenty of wounded and dead on the battlefield. Deep within the little battle wagon fort, King Vladislav and Hunyadi pulled counsel with the rest of the leadership. Hunyadi, it is said, was the first to speak. He basically reminded those present that, yes, they had suffered heavy casualties, but the souls who passed on this day were, at this very second, joined with the Father in heaven and secured an eternal bliss because they died in a crusade. Now, for more earthly matters, it was best, he said, to wait the Ottomans out. Hunyadi reminded everyone that he had secured his past victories because he had allowed the Ottomans to attack and then exhaust themselves. The Turks, he said, were either going to run away or sue for peace sometime later. No risk, guys. There's no risk in risking anything at this point. Hunyadi added that in a way the day was actually theirs because it had been the Ottomans who had pulled back and disengaged. On the note of casualties and losses, Hunyadi reminded everyone that the Ottomans still had around 45,000 troops left, while the Crusaders, though they had lost less than the Ottomans, were much weaker because they started out with less. I can only imagine the consternation and rage Hunyadi experienced when King Vladislav brushed all this aside and announced that no, they wouldn't sit around and do nothing. The king and his bodyguard hadn't had much fighting that day, despite the drama and death going on the flanks of the army. Egged on by the young hotheads and his bodyguard, the rich and privileged youth of Europe, the king decided he would lead his 500-man detachment for a triumphant charge straight into the Ottoman center and kill Murad. Hunyadi begged, pleaded, threatened, even tried to bribe the king away from this decision, but his mind was well made up. The decision was disastrous in the immediate tactical sense too, because Hunyadi had planned on using this 500 force of heavy knights, the most well-trained, well-armed, and armored of the entire Crusader force, as an ultimate reserve to be deployed in dire circumstances, but preferably as the finishing move against the Ottoman foe. To send in his best, along with their king, towards the center of the Ottoman lines, that would be throwing away his most lethal contingent and best hope of beating the Ottomans. Also, what if King Vladislav died in this suicidal assault? Even if the Crusaders were successful and overran the Ottomans and killed Murad, if King Vladislav died, it would mean an end to the union of Poland and Hungary, and most likely plunge Hungary into yet another civil war. The Crusaders would have won a spectacular victory they could all brag about, yes, but losing their king would mean an end to the strategic unity the Christians had enjoyed. The Ottomans would be losing what? A former sultan, even though he was a spectacular commander, and they'd be out a large army. But in the end, the Ottomans would still have Sultan Mehmed II at the helm, and they could easily throw together another army, Hunyadi reminded everyone. I can't but wonder at the hand Cardinal Cesarini played in the king's decision. Remember what I said about Vladislav staying up around the campfire, as the papal legate spun tales about how they were all going to be legends? Well, legends they would become, just not in the way Cesarini or the king imagined. Hunyadi mounted a small hill and watched as the king rode out at the head of his 500 men. Meanwhile, over in the Ottoman camp, Murad had become anxious. The Christian army hadn't broken under the combined weight of his superior Ottoman force. His troops, though proportionally less heavy losses than the Christians, still had suffered terribly that day. All this fighting, and Hunyadi's lines hadn't been shattered. What Murad didn't want was for this battle to drag out. And then, word spread that the Ottomans were having a tough go of it up in Europe. It might give their enemies in the East ideas. Discussing these problems with his generals and agas, and supposedly throwing around the idea of a truce, Murad's thoughts were interrupted by shouts. then screams, then maddening cries from his troops at the front lines. Rushing out of his command tent, Murad witnessed hundreds of Europe's best, finest, and most heavily armed knights, in full battle array, banners waving in the wind, thundering up the hill directly at him. Murad's Azab and Sapiha infantry holding his center, thousands upon thousands of them, broke ranks and ran away from the Christian charge, and were scattered to the four winds, many having been cut down in the process. Within a matter of minutes, the knights' horses jumped over the spike fortifications and were charging straight at Murad's headquarters. Losing his nerve, Murad stumbled to the ground. He picked himself back up and had to be helped onto his horse. He was ready at that moment to throw in the towel, army be damned, and save his own skin. How might history have been different then if Murad had managed to run away at this critical juncture? However, this was a time before sultans became the imperial masters of the world, separate and distinct from the common soldier. Murad was the last of his kind, a sultan who considered himself no different from the average Ghazi, who ate with his men, dressed simply, and took the average share of booty after a battle and no more, and also shared in the hardships of his own men. Times were changing though, and his son Mehmed II was a sign of the coming imperial sultanate, an epoch where the sultan would become, quote, the shadow of God upon the earth, end quote. No longer the Ghazi everyman, the soldier's sultan, but distant, alien, and even semi-divine. As such, one of his longest-serving and most battle-hardened soldiers intervened to save the day. In fact, it pleases me to allow me to use the words of the Ottoman historian Nasiri to describe what happened next. A battle-hardened Janissary held the reins forcefully of Murad's horse and refused his master to run away, and instead shouted very loudly for everyone to hear, quote, Sultan, admirable lord, Ottoman Murad, get off your horse this minute. To die with us, and we with you, O master, end quote. The Janissary shout pierced the din of the rushing knights, and a fighting spirit invigorated all the Ottomans on top of the hill. The Aga of the Janissaries strode up to Murad, pushed this Janissary aside, placed a hand on his master's arm. What he whispered has long since been lost to history. His Janissaries surrounding him, Murad dismounted his horse and prepared to die with his men. The knights successfully then broke through the outer cordon straight into Murad's headquarters. These Janissaries swarmed the knights from all directions, pulling them from their horses, pushing ice beneath their helmets. Battle axes broke bone and skull, maces swung, and Christian armor relented. I should mention here the terrible toll the arquebus took on the knights as well. Even though the Janissaries only managed a single shot each, the 1,000 rounds did do their damage at such close range. By the time the knights had ridden up the hill, there couldn't have been more than 200 of them left alive. However, the momentum of their attack continued and cut through to Murad himself now, and King Vladislav is said to have prepared and try to deliver the final blow. His epic chapter in history, however, was short-lived, as a Janissary ran forth and struck the legs of his horse, sending him flying off his mound, and he lay immobile on the ground, no doubt suffered some catastrophic injury as a result of his fall. The Janissary rushed over, removed his helmet, and decapitated the king. He then laid the head at the foot of Murad, declaring, quote, Fortunate Lord, God has seen fit to deliver this finely dressed enemy at your feet, end quote. Watching his only chance at beating the Ottomans at Varna dissipate, Hunyadi could do little. He ordered the crusaders, or what was left of them, to decamp and assume more defensible positions further away. Almost as soon as the crusaders began their retreat, the foot soldiers began to desert in droves. By the next day, Murad's forces surrounded what was left of the Crusaders and proceeded to decimate their numbers. Mircea II made his way back to Wallachia. Along the way, Hunyadi was arrested by one of the Vlad Draculas, but released after the Council of Crusaders threatened war against Wallachia. This wouldn't be the last time Murad and Hunyadi faced off either. A few years later, the Europeans would put together another expeditionary force and face off in what history calls the Second Battle of Kosovo. From what I've read about this Battle of Varna, most historians say this was the very last attempt by the Europeans to mount a united effort to drive the Turks from Europe. However, I'm not sure that it is quite the case, at least if you were looking at things from the Ottoman perspective. Decades later, several more attempts to drive the Ottomans out of Europe were attempted. Some were more successful than others. As an end note, I tried to find out what happened to Cardinal Cesarini. It looks like on day two, when the Crusaders finally broke, the good Cardinal tried to make a run for it. But he ended up being cut down by his own men, so I'm not quite sure what happened there. Before closing this episode out, I'd like to throw out there that if any of my listeners have a solid story on exactly what happened to Cardinal Cesarini, please, I'd appreciate it if you'd shoot me an email with that information at empiresofhistorypodcast@gmail.com. I've been throwing around the idea of doing a special on the Cardinal, and I'm kind of reluctant to do it till I kind of figure out exactly what happened to him. So if you have that information, I am very, very interested in it. And if I do decide to do an extra episode, I'll give you a shout out. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Empire's Podcast, The Ottomans. I'd like to ask you to leave me a 5-star review on Apple Podcast. If you're listening on Spotify, you can scroll up and click 5-star review tab and leave me some street cred. But most of all, guys, please tell a friend about Empire's Podcast, The Ottomans. Until next time.